In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
It's believed that Rh negative initially stemmed from Cro-Magnon man, which is precisely that the primate that the Anunnaki inseminated or took sperm from to create humans. If Cro-Magnon man was in fact Rh negative, then that would help to explain partially the reason why there is 15% of humans have Rh negative.
If you enjoy Conspiracy Unlimited, why not become a Conspiracy Unlimited Plus member? For just $1.99 per month, you'll gain access to two bonus, exclusive, commercial-free episodes per month, plus access to my back catalog of episodes. To subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Gain Access to Premium Episodes. Again, go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes, or click on the link in the episode notes. Conspiracy Unlimited Plus for less than $2 per month. Why not sign up today?
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
My guest is passionate about the study of human evolution and extraterrestrial intervention in the human experience. He's been influenced by such researchers as Eric von Daniken and Zechariah Sitchin. He's here to present evidence that we are the product of ET genetic manipulation. He's concluded that extraterrestrial beings known as the Anunnaki visited Earth starting around 450,000 years ago. And genetically altered early humans. He considers the Anunnaki to be gods rather than God, and suggested they correlate with the fallen angels or Nephilim described in the Bible. The Anunnaki made several different versions of Adam and Eve. They tweaked and tweaked until they got it right, he says, adding that DNA manipulation involved the fusing of the 45th and 46th chromosomes.
He says there's physical evidence on our planet that we've been visited and interacted with, such as gold mines in South Africa dating back 250,000 years, monoliths and megaliths such as Stonehenge, technology like the Antikythera mechanism and the Baghdad Battery and the Nazca lines, which can only be seen from an aerial view. Leon Bibby is the author of Atom Equals Alien, Volume 1. He's an historian and a researcher of archaeology, human and ancient history, biology, Egyptology, and religious philosophy. He's an adjunct professor of alternative science featured and a featured guest on Coast to Coast AM, and he will be featured in an upcoming episode of the History Channel's Ancient Alien series. His latest book is Atom Decoded, Volume 2. Leon, how are you?
Well, thanks, Richard. Thank you very much for having me.
We've talked quite a bit about Zachariah Sitchin. I had him on the program many, many years ago. And just recently, we also talked about the Anunnaki. I wanted to get your perspective on the planet Nibiru. Now, you lay out some evidence that the existence of Nibiru has been established. It's a brown dwarf. Talk to me a little bit about the evidence that this planet actually exists.
Right. So both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times refer to Nibiru as Planet X. And the planet has been captured by the Hubble telescope, as well as actually been seen in the north from Norway at certain times of the year. It's definitely within our solar system, within the Milky Way. It lies four times the distance from outside of Pluto as Pluto is to the sun. It's a very large planet, 44,000 miles long. It comes into an elliptical orbit every 3,600 years between Mars and Jupiter. And it has a lot to do with Earth's original unicellular organism growth. Meaning when it originally, supposedly, according to Sitchin, knocked into Earth Tiamat, it sort of fused, and cells were exchanged. And the Earth then became unicellular 500 million years after that.
So simply because of its close proximity when it swings by on this elliptical orbit, that in itself aided in sort of the, let's call it the evolutionary process. Is that the gist of it?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, it goes further than panspermia. Which was Crick's theory.
Right.
It's more of a direct intervention, I guess you'd say, a direct exchange of DNA. And the DNA piece is really the key to solving the mystery of the missing link.
Now, you point out something very interesting in Atom Decoded about Nibiru, and that is that the symbol for that planet is a cross. How do we know that?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I always, you know, thought about the cross in Christianity and its depiction everywhere on Earth. And it was depicted in the Sumerian tablets as the planet of the crossing. That's what it was called. And the reason it's called that is because it came into our orbit between Mars and Jupiter every 3,600 years. And 3,600 is the sexadecimal system, which was key in the Sumerian arithmetic and geometry and the way that they put together their mathematics. And so it basically crossed into our orbit and basically causes a lot of flux and a lot of gravitational pull and problems among the planets, especially Earth. I think it had a lot to do with the flood, supposedly 12,000 years ago. That's why it's called Planet of the Crossing.
And the orbit, every time it swings by, what is the approximate the timing in terms of its encounter with our planet? Is it 36,000 years?
Every 3,600.
3,600. My apologies. Every 3,600. If you were to put a timeline together of major cataclysmic events on the Earth. You mentioned the flood. We could talk about ice ages and so forth. We could talk about major tectonic activity, major volcanic activity. Would it line up with the orbit of Nibiru and its encounter with Earth?
I think so. I think it has a lot to do with it. I think starting from single cell in my timeline in Adam equals Alien, I list a timeline from pages 1 through 6. It first starts out at 3.9 billion years ago, single cell bacterial development. And then there is multicellular bacterial development, 400 million BC. Ice ages do coincide with its elliptical orbit between Mars and Jupiter. So we do see, and I'll list the ice ages that are listed in the timeline. There's initially a planetary pole shift, 50,000 BC, which is 1,000 years, supposedly 1,000 years after Nibiru came into our orbit. The second was the cataclysm flood, 11,500, which coincides to within 500 years of the next shift. And then the last was, the last could have been 6,000 BC. So it does wrap around that same, timeline.
Right, right. And when is it expected to swing by again, roughly?
So hopefully never, but I listed in my book that I think it's going to swing at 3100 AD.
Not till 3100. All right.
Right.
These claims that it's coming by and it can be spotted by and it has been spotted by various amateur astronomers and so forth, and there was even a conspiracy theory that some of them have been knocked off to prevent this information from leaking out. I mean, is it visible from any? Could it be visible at this point from any telescope?
I think so. I've seen pictures of it from Earth, so I believe that Hubble, sure, and I believe certainly the telescope in New Mexico, the Vatican telescope, some of those larger scale telescopes, I'm sure have pictures of it already. The fact that the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal have both printed the fact that it's calling it Planet X, saying that it contains carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, and the fact that it's a similar body to Earth, definitely, to me, foretells that the people in the know. I think if they do know about the Sumerian tablets and what the Sumerian tablets have said, that they certainly can tell that this is the same planet that's discussed in them.
I just want to touch on the Sumerian tablets for a moment. These are, roughly 7,000 years old, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
I'd like to clarify what the tablets actually say about the Anunnaki. Does it actually describe the Anunnaki? Does it describe them as being extraterrestrial? What does it tell us about them?
So the tablets were found in Iraq between 1894 and 1900, 30,000 of them. And about 7,000 or 8,000 have been deciphered, translated to English and several other languages. And they've had linguists from University of Pennsylvania, Samuel Noah Kramer is one of them that has translated them, Zakaria Sitchin, one of the greatest authors in this space, has certainly translated. And yes, they do directly discuss the Anakim, the Anunnaki. Anakim is also mentioned in the Bible, in the Old Testament, several times, actually about 700 times. So yes, they mention them directly. They mention that they are humanoid, that they are approximately 9 feet tall, bearded, pale skin, blue eyes, blonde hair, typically either blonde or red hair, very muscular, speaking a dialect similar to Hebrew, and very power hungry. Very similar to humans today. There are sects that are power hungry and warlike, and then there are sects that are caring and loving want to educate their offspring, basically the humans. And so, yes, they're directly discussed in the tablets, and Enki and Lil are two of the main characters in the Sumerian tablets, Enki being sort of the pro-Homo sapien, pro-human god with a small g god, and Enlil being the tough, I believe him to be the god of the Israelites, jealous god, creating war and possibly even setting off nukes in Sodom and Gomorrah. So, yes, directly discussed several times their life, their history, where they come from, why they came to Earth, which I find is fascinating, sort right. of on the same path as Earth. And yes, so many, many times discussed.
And the purpose of them being here has to do with a gold mining operation, which
yep.
which connects to their atmosphere, which requires gold particulates, correct?
That's right. Exactly right. I believe that they nuked their atmosphere to the point of losing their ozone. And even though they're so far away from our sun, from Pluto, they still have another sun, so they're a binary sun system. They have heat within their core, which keeps the planet warm. But they still nuked their atmosphere, their ozone layer depleted. They needed some sort of metal to blow up into the atmosphere that was light enough to push back heat because they were getting irradiated. They were dying from radiation. So they needed some metal that they could use to blow up and push back, to hold back the heat. And metal, gold is perfect because it's thin, it's malleable. It sustains heat. You know, we see them on all of our telescopes and our satellites, and our, you know, and our rockets. We use gold on the outside to keep as a heat shield. So it's the perfect metal, and they didn't have that on Nibiru. They found it. It's funny. The Sumerian tablets mentioned that it was very prevalent in what they call the hammered bracelet, which is our asteroid belt. And they actually tried. It's amazing, Richard. There's one tablet, which I couldn't find a good picture of for my book, but one tablet actually shows the picture of a V-shaped rocket navigating through past Pluto and through the hammered bracelet and trying to get through the hammered bracelet towards Earth. There were dots towards Earth. And they had a lot of trouble getting through the asteroid belt. Many of their ships were destroyed. So that initial mission failed because they wanted to land the ship on one of the asteroid belts and mine gold, but they couldn't do it. So they ended up then going to Mars, creating a way station there, and then from Mars to Earth. And it was very, very, they found it to be very prevalent in Africa initially.
How did they know they would find gold here?
Yeah, that's a good, very good question. I think that they initially sent out missions. From what I've read, they sent out missions. One of the Anunnaki named Alalu was, I guess, one of their first missionaries, and he literally would fly around in space to find where gold was. As far as how he knew how it was on Earth, I don't know. I guess he had some detector that was able to pick it up, but I'm not sure.
And so the actual gold mining operation involved enslaving primitive hominids. Is that the idea?
Yeah, basically, they initially had about 300 Anunnaki, 200 of which were called Ijiji in the Sumerian tablets, and the Ijiji were sort of the blue collar workers, the mine workers that they brought along with them. And the Ijiji were mining in South Africa, and digging the ditches. And they couldn't just use lasers to get through the ground and then get the gold out. They had to do it sort of by mining, by manual work. And according to the tablets, after a certain amount of time, I think it was thousands and thousands of years, after a certain amount of time, via Gigi, started to get upset and say, you know, look, we can't do this anymore. We're on strike. And Enki, which was, you know, one of the gods I just mentioned, came up with a solution, brought it to the pantheon of gods and said, look, we need to create a slave worker, a humanoid that's, that can help dig the gold. And so basically they tried several times using their own DNA with primate DNA, and then failed several times because of the way they were doing it with crystal jars versus clay jars. And then they were inseminating Anunnaki eggs in primate, Anunnaki sperm in primate uterus. That didn't work. And then several times, and, you know, these depictions where you see humans with one leg and humans with three heads, and I believe were all true. I believe that they were all mistakes that they went through the thousands of years from 432,000 B.C. to about 270,000 B.C. in trying to create a Homo sapien that's not too intelligent, but that could mine and hear and speak to a degree, but just do the manual work.
And is there evidence of these gold mining operations, for example, or would we would expect to find evidence of a gold mining operation dating back 250,000 years ago? Where is the evidence for that?
Yeah, there actually is evidence in South Africa of gold of mines. It's interesting to note that Michael Tellinger, has mentioned in several of his books that there's actually human bones found 80 feet, 90 feet down in these mines that are 200,000 years old. And so when I read about that, you know, my first thought was, you know, what would any rational human being be caught 80 feet down in a mine, you know, 80,000 years ago? Those aren't the priorities. Priorities are, you know, getting food, shelter, procreating, these things, not digging gold.
What about the technology? Because this is an advanced race of humanoid. They would, one would suppose, have access to some pretty sophisticated mining equipment. Has anything like that been found underground?
No. They haven't found any sophisticated equipment, which I find to be interesting. It appears that the Anunnaki took everything back with them. But there is direct evidence, and I have it in my book, Adam Decoded, but direct evidence in the pyramids, the Giza pyramids, where there have been huge saw marks, electrical saw marks, 9 feet, 10-foot saw marks that have been initiated, and then there have been a mistake, and then pulled out, and then started again in granite, in 9-foot, you know, deep granite, which is impossible, you know, 3,000-4,000 years ago with copper tools to have done. There's also pictures of laser holes that are threaded exactly as lasers are today, with diamond-tipped laser heads. And so it's impossible to create these holes through 9 feet of granite or dolomite without a diamond-tipped laser, you know. Even today's, you know, what they call these sound oscillating lasers can't do what they did 200,000 years ago. There's a very, very good engineer named Christopher Dunn. I don't know if you've had him on your show before, but he's written several books about the Giza pyramids and about how he believes that they acted as machines. And he's an electrical and a mechanical engineer. And he talks about how the thread marks in these holes, in these boring holes, are incredible. And the symmetry within these holes basically replicate them using vibratory and oscillating and sound to create 500 times faster drill bits speed than we can do today. So it's just incredible the amount of evidence that at least exists, you know, in the Giza pyramids.
Adam Decoded, Volume 2, is Leon Bibby's latest book. And I want to get back to the genetic experiment here. Is there anything in the cuneiforms that describes, for example, how human DNA was manipulated? Because you in the book you talk about, for example, the 45th and 46th chromosomes. Talk to me about DNA and the manipulation.
So the Sumerian tablets talk in poetry, actually, which is very interesting, but they talk about how Enki produced a human through his, they call it heavenly essence. And the heavenly essence basically is DNA. You know, it's talked about basically on several occasions throughout the Bible as that, you know, the snake-like appearance, and snake-like, symbols. But I think the key with me is that after reading Francis Crick, and Hoyle and them cracking the DNA code in 1950, basically, you know, we have 30,000 genes, we have 46 chromosomes, primates have 44. And in one of his books, he basically shows a comparison between a primate DNA and a human DNA. And in between 45 and 46, it looks like almost as if it were either put back in or a fusion. And I show that in my first book, Adam Equals Alien, and it sort of looks like the shape of an S. And if you would have taken the original primate DNA and snipping out portions of it, which I believe are two specific genes, FOXP2 and MYH16. Those two genes, FOXP2 gave us speech, which primates don't have, and there's a two-molecule difference between their FOXP2 and ours, and MYH16, which enhances cranial development. And so these two SNPs and ADDs were those, in my opinion, those two genes. Although I'm looking for more in my third book, which is called Blood Origins. But those two specifically are what Crick noticed and what I also saw him show in one of his books. And I just thought it was incredible. But it just looked like a test tube baby, basically, where you snip out and tweezer back, you know, portions of telomeres, they're called.
Fascinating. And what about people talk about Nick Redfern wrote a book about, you know, the blood type and how only a small percentage is it the Rh?
Rh negative.
The Rh negative, yes, mm-hmm. Which is not a blood type. That's more of a marker, if I'm correct.
Yes.
Does that figure into this theory as well?
Yes,
the Rh negative.
You're hitting on some very, very key points in my in book three. So we basically have blood types O, which is the most prevalent. We have A, which is the least, B, second least, AB. And within those, O, A, B, and AB, usually we're Rh positive. I know I'm Rh positive. The majority of human beings, 85% of human beings are Rh positive, Rh coming from rhesus, the rhesus monkey.
Adam Decoded, Volume 2, Leon Bibby, my guest. Don't go away. Reduce stress and enhance your immune system. ESS 60 from C60 Evo. C60 is the carbon-60 molecule known to deliver more than 172 times the power of vitamin C. 172 times. ESS 60 is the purest form of C60, a known antiviral, antibacterial, and anti-inflammatory remedy that works. ESS 60 neutralizes free radicals from cell metabolization and external toxins to help minimize inflammation and maximize detoxification. Further, people report better sleep, more energy, and renewed mental clarity when they take our ESS 60 organic oil. To order your miracle molecule ESS 60, click on the C60 Evo link in the episode notes for this podcast, or go to c60evo.com/Richard-Serrett. C60evo.com/Richard-Serrett. Buy now and save 10% by using the coupon code EVRS at checkout. Again, use the coupon code EVRS at checkout.
As you're staring up at the night sky, ever wonder who's staring back?
No, me either. But I guess you better say it because of Richard. You know, he's all wrapped up in this stuff.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Welcome back. Leon Bibby stays with us. Adam Decoded, Volume 2, is his latest. So we were talking about blood types and Rh negative. I want you to continue on and finish that thought before we move on to other matters.
Sure. So four different types of blood, O, A, B, AB, Rh positive, Rh negative, Rh positive being the most prevalent, 85%. It's believed that Rh negative initially stemmed from Cro-Magnon man, which is precisely that the primate that the Anunnaki inseminated or took sperm from to create humans. If Cro-Magnon man was in fact Rh negative, then that would help to explain partially the reason why there is 15% of humans have Rh negative. Specifically, an area in Spain, Morocco, called the Basques. And these people that live in the Pyrenees Mountains, the Basques, have something around 80% of them have Rh negative blood. So scientists are bewildered where the Rh negative came from. If Darwin were correct and Cro-Magnons eventually, through natural selection, mutated into Homo sapiens, first there aren't any fossils to prove that, but if they did, then certainly, it would either be mutated out and there would only be a Rh positive, or some external event happened to continue that, because they died out. They died out 30,000 years ago. They were 120,000 up to 30,000. So they outlasted the Neanderthals, but they died out. We know that. So they died out. So if they died out, how did the Rh negative then continue to the Basques? We don't know.
And for the 50% that are not Rh negative, that are Rh positive,
right.
How do we explain that?
I think the Rh negative, if it did come from the Anunnaki, which I think is a very reasonable theory, then that would have passed down, and I think Nick Redfern is right on the money, passed down from the original humans, from the Noah, the several Noahs that were created down through, I'm sorry, the several Adams that were created down through Noah, Moses, Jesus, and then through the bloodlines, specific and only blood to blood, keeping within themselves. And so I believe that, Rh negative is an external blood that came through and that were kept within bloodlines to maintain power, to maintain history, to maintain, familial genetics.
All right. Now, I'm a Bible-believing Christian, and I believe the flood was basically God deciding to chlorinate the gene pool because the fallen angels had commingled with the daughters of men and created this genetic hybrid, these offspring, the Nephilim. And so in the ancient alien theory, how is the flood explained? I mean, is it Enlil basically upset because Enki created or helped create, I guess, along with the Lady of the Earth, Ninma, created this genetic hybrid?
Yeah, it's a very good question. From what I've read in the tablets and the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, it seems as if Enlil never liked humans from the start, was opposed to the idea of creating humans to begin with, didn't want them to be too smart, which is, I think, part of the reason why, we have 90% of our DNA turned off, basically, quote-unquote, turned off. But he didn't like them. They were too, quote-unquote, noisy. It's mentioned in the Sumerian tablets that they created too much noise. The Tower of Babel, I think, is one of the precursors to the animosity. And it's interesting. I have in my book, my second book, Adam Decoded, that there's a depiction in one of the Sumerian tablets of of a missile. And the depiction starts underground and goes over underground, and the top of the missile, the rocket, is above. And so the Tower of Babel, in my opinion, was an attempt by humans to create a rocket to go up to heaven, quote-unquote. And I think this infuriated Enlil. I think he thought then that humans are getting too smart. They want to become, they think that they are gods like us, and something has to be done. And so I think that's why they either used an asteroid to create the flood or some other gravitational force that made the Antarctic ice slip and then create massive, you know, waves and basically kill 98% of the humans on Earth.
This family squabble, I mean, how entrenched was it? What else did Enlil try to do to seek retribution on Enki? And to did he try and destroy the human race again after the flood? Tell me about that.
So Enlil and Enki were children of Anu, Anu being the supreme god of the Anunnaki, and Enki being the son of Anu and his wife, first wife, and Enlil being the son of Anu and his sort of mistress. And there had always been jealousy between Enlil and Enki, Enki thinking that he should be the one sole leader. And Enlil seems to be favored by Anu, because when they came down to Earth, Anu specifically gave Enlil, being the, you know, the god of the Earth, and the main decision maker in the main missile areas, the rocket areas, and where the UFOs landed, Lebanon, Israel, all the Middle East, and they basically gave Enki Africa. So they sort of gave Enki the oversight of the mining, which was the toil, the hard work. And Enlil sort of became that jealous god and overseeing all of the ships coming in and out, the energy needed to keep the ships going, which I think was through pyramids, etc. So there was always animosity between Enlil and Enki. And there was infighting between these gods as well. It's mentioned several times in the Sumerian tablets, in the Mahabharata, the Indian sacred texts. It's mentioned the flying Vimanas shooting each other with missiles of mass destruction. It even mentions nuclear attack on each other in Israel. And there's a chapter in my first book, Adam Equals Alien, called Vitrification. And Vitrification shows a picture of it used to be a mountain in Israel in the Negev desert, which is now almost sliced off as if it were as if it looked like a volcano, and it's just sliced off, and the top having all these remnants of vitrified calcite and glass. And Israeli geologists have no idea where this could have come from, because there's no volcano there. And there wasn't any crater signifying a meteorite or anything of that nature. So they're bewildered. There's also vitrified glass in Africa, in the deserts in Africa. So there's definitely proof that there was nuclear bombs thrown between exchange between the Anunnaki and then as it relates to your first question, did it happen after Tower of Babel? I think it did. I think Sodom and Gomorrah was a direct nuclear attack on the humans, and it's obviously mentioned in the Bible where Lot's wife turns around, becomes a pillar of salt, which I find is very, very interesting, because in Hebrew, salt means vaporized. Another word for salt is vaporized. And the words that they used in the Bible, basically that the blinding light and other words that they couldn't eat, humans couldn't eat afterwards, became sick, vomited, just to me are just direct it's a direct signification that, that's, you know, that's radiation from a nuclear blast. And also,
that's
lastly,
that's some sibling rivalry.
I know, I have a brother, but I would never do that.
Hurl around a few nuclear bombs. Yeah, we just put a piece of tape down the middle of our bedroom, and we say, "You stay over there, and I'll stay over here," but not Enlil and Enki.
I found it really interesting. I want to mention this. I don't know if you've ever heard this, but Robert Oppenheimer, in 1952, yes, who was the father of the nuclear bomb in New Mexico, had a speaking engagement at Rochester, University of Rochester, and he spoke to a big group of people about how he felt after exploding the bomb. And somebody asked him, and it's all written down in the meeting, you know, how did you feel about being the father of the first nuclear bomb? And he answered that that he was not proud of creating the nuclear bomb, but that this was not the first. And he said it clearly.
Right.
So he knew.
Now, what about getting from Earth to Nibiru today? Is that still possible? Does Nibiru need to be in our vicinity, or can we use stargates to get there? How would that work?
I think they use stargates. I think the pillar of, you know, the Dome of the Rock in Israel, I think that it's my presumption that this was a stargate, that's one of the reasons why this dome is so, first of all, why it was covered with gold, was that it was a signification to UFOs that this is a spot, this is a stargate. So I believe, yes, I believe that was a stargate. There are other stargates, Chile, Peru, that I've read about. But yes, a stargate, I think, is obviously the most efficient way of doing it. I personally haven't read into how it's done. I'm certain that it uses the Einstein-Rosen bridge theory, and that's how they manipulate time and space to get there. Or you can obviously fly at light speed or greater than light speed to get there. Not sure how many light years away they are, but it's way past Pluto, so I think it would take a long time.
In your book, Adam Decoded, you say that Nibiru is heaven.
Mm.
Explain.
I always wondered what heaven was, and I always thought as a child, and even before I started reading heavily about this, I always thought heaven was sort of the sky and the clouds, and I never really pinned heaven as being a planet. And after doing so much reading of the Sumerian tablets, I feel, it's again my theory, that the Anunnaki were our small g, not big G, gods, plural. They did create us. This is pre-religion, pre-Judaism, pre-Christianity, pre-Muslim faith. And if they did, and they are from Nibiru, then I believe that the humans that were developed and from them worship them as their god or gods, and that heaven was the place where they wanted to go. I think that this is why the Egyptians embalmed their dynasties as mummies. I believe that they were encapsulating their DNA, and even though that their bodies died, I still believe that their DNA was capable of being reused, either on Nibiru or on Earth again. And so I sort of equated Nibiru to heaven. And so that's what I think, you know, humans thought heaven was.
Is it inhabitable for humans? Is it hospitable to humans?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I from what I've read, you know, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen. So it's got three of the main components that humans need. How much oxygen? I don't know. I do know that Earth's gravity is such that it creates a stress on these telomeres, which are connectors between two DNA strands. So the Anunnaki, when they came here, were aging quicker than their norm. And they lived tens of thousands of years. They're 500 million years ahead of us, which is significant. I'm sure that they figured out how to extend their lives almost to, they're living forever. They were capable of dying, which is interesting, but they were aging here. And I think that there was a lot of stress on their body, and that's why they kept leaving and coming back. So I think that humans probably could live on Nibiru, maybe in, certain encapsulated buildings, but I think it is possible.
You have a picture, a photograph in Adam Decoded. It is reportedly the only photograph taken from Nibiru's surface. Tell me about the origins of that photograph.
Right. This was, I wasn't sure what to believe of this initially, but after showing this to a few of my fellow authors that I'm sort of in a little group of authors that write about the ancient alien space, they believe that this is legitimate. They believe that this is comes from one of the smaller islands in Norway, and that it was taken through a very powerful lens. I don't know which camera, but it's passed down through several authors, several UFO researchers, apparently a couple people from NASA even, and they are saying that NASA is basically saying that they're not sure if it's Planet X, but some of the articles from the Wall Street Journal, New York Times have said that this is certainly possible to be the only photograph. So if it is, then it's pretty miraculous that it was taken from Earth.
And what is the status of Nibiru today? Do we know? Is it inhabited? Is it a dead planet? Is it a thriving, Anunnaki civilization?
Yeah, Richard, I think it's thriving just like Earth. I think it's got millions of people. I don't know how many millions. They're humanoids just like us, but well advanced than us. They apparently have stabilized their atmosphere. Otherwise, we'd see them more, I think. The last Anunnaki left 200 BC, but many of them left 2000 BC. So the last group left 200 BC. So we haven't seen them for 2,200 years. But yeah, I believe that they're living there. I believe that they probably stabilized their atmosphere, and they're headed back.
They're coming back, folks.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review, because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.